Welcome back to another episode of City Hall Pass. I'm Kapel Lungani, counsel to the mayor of New York City. We created this forum, the first of its kind in New York City, to give you, the public, a unique window into the highest levels of our city government. We interview New York City's finest public servants and get them to open up in a way that is both deeply personal and insightful. And on its best days, we hope that our podcast is equal parts educational and inspiring. And now I want to introduce my two co-hosts today, two brilliant women who inspire me every day, Bess Chu and Kate Coughlin.
Thanks, Kapel. Happy to be here. This is Bess Chu. I'm currently Chief of Staff to the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
Hi, I'm Kate Coughlin, and I currently serve as Deputy Counsel for the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
I'm excited to introduce our guest today, the founder and CEO of Union Square Hospitality Group, Danny Meyer. Danny's Union Square Hospitality Group, also known as USHG, comprises some of New York's most beloved and acclaimed restaurants, including Gramercy Tavern, The Modern, Maialino, and more. Danny and USHG founded Shake Shack, which became a public company in 2015. USHG is renowned not only for its acclaimed restaurants, but also for its distinctive and celebrated culture of enlightened hospitality. This guiding principle of prioritizing employees first and foremost has driven and shaped USHG's ongoing evolution from a small group of restaurants into a multifaceted hospitality organization. Danny and USHG's diverse ventures have added to the hospitality dialogue in many contexts, including dining options in museums, sports arenas, and cultural institutions, as well as prescient investments in burgeoning neighborhoods. Danny has set industry standards in areas such as hiring practices, innovative leadership, and corporate responsibility. We spoke to Danny about his journey as an entrepreneur. Danny shared the interesting story about the birth of Shake Shack and talked to us about his commitment to serving not just his customers, but his community. We hope you enjoy.
I want to give a warm City Hall Pass welcome to the great Danny Meyer. Danny, thank you so much for joining us today. We very much appreciate it.
I'm very happy to be with you.
Danny, my family has owned small businesses for many years, and as we all know, it's certainly not for the faint of heart. Being an entrepreneur is an inherently risky endeavor. Your father, Danny, was an entrepreneur. How did his experience influence you?
My dad was one of these serial entrepreneurs who never met an idea that he didn't want to try. And the area that he really thought about the most was travel and hospitality. Without even realizing it, I was getting an education in what would be my career as a kid. My parents had spent the first 2 years of their marriage living in a small town in France because he was a counterintelligence officer in the army. And because there weren't too many altercations, I guess, they spent a good amount of their time traveling the countryside and looking for restaurants and inns and getting to know the innkeepers. And that then led him to a career in the travel business and planning tours for people. And ultimately, he became the United States representative for a burgeoning small group of country inns, which at the time was called Relais de Campagne and later became Relais and Chateau. So we always had French people living in our home and a little dog named Ratatouille. You know, I was learning, and I was learning about what would become my profession without even knowing it.
Speaking of that, Danny, you had a Eurocentric upbringing. How did that European influence affect your approach to the culinary arts and more generally towards the hospitality industry?
You know, growing up in St. Louis, where, you know, this was a time before anyone had ever heard of things like arugula and extra virgin olive oil and balsamic vinegar. You know, we were pretty good customers of bird's eye frozen peas and you know, that kind of thing. But I just loved going out to eat. And even in St. Louis, where a lot of the food was, I guess the food was okay. And in fact, I have to give St. Louis credit for putting the idea of Shake Shack into my head originally, and also maybe even Blue Smoke, which was our barbecue restaurant. But the real love I had for food came when we would get to take these trips because of my dad's travel business. I got to go to France for the first time when I was 7 years old, and my parents made me keep a diary. And I found that diary recently, and I was writing about, at the age of seven, eating quiche Lorraine and creme fraiche with fraise de bois, wild baby strawberries. I mean, that's not the kind of thing a seven-year-old in St. Louis was doing back in the 1960s. But I just really feel that my hospitality instincts came out in an interesting way, because when I was 20, I worked for my dad as a tour guide based in Rome. And I was the guy that had to pick up the cranky jet-lagged Americans every, you know, few mornings at the airport, get on the bus. And I just had this kind of internal game I was playing, which is that whoever was the crankiest on day one, I was going to turn into the happiest by day five. I found ways to do it, and I was good at it.
You know, having been exposed to the travel industry, tour industry, did you ever think about going into a business other than restaurants?
I never thought about going into the restaurant business. So to answer your question, absolutely. My interest was more like you. I was a political junkie. I still am. I love politics. I was a poli-sci major at Trinity College in Hartford, and Trinity has a campus in Rome. And I went for a semester studying international politics, worked at the Food and Agriculture Organization, which is part of the United Nations. And of course, my minor was trattorias, because I couldn't stay out of the restaurants. But it never, ever dawned on me that I would go into the food business. I thought that if you were interested in politics, and I have to say, I was volunteering on a congressional campaign in St. Louis at the age of 10, handing out bumper stickers, and worked on many campaigns, including professionally in 1980 for John Anderson's presidential campaign. He was the independent candidate who ran against Carter and Reagan. And I had a Senate internship when I was 18 in Washington for our U.S. Senator from Missouri. So that's what I thought I wanted to do. And interestingly, after working on the John Anderson campaign, I realized that the game of running for office, as exciting as it was just not something I was interested in. Where no matter how many dollars you raised, they weren't enough. No matter how many hours you worked, they weren't enough. No matter how many signatures you got, they weren't enough. And I found that I was more interested in issues than I was in being a politician. So even though I took my LSATs, because that was the pathway to going into politics, it had become abundantly clear to me that that's not really what I wanted to do. So after taking the LSATs, I never applied, possibly because I didn't do well, possibly because I had no interest in being the worst attorney in the history of the country. I was just really lucky that the night before taking my LSATs, I happened to be out for dinner with my aunt and uncle here in Manhattan. And I was in a foul mood. And my uncle asked me what was wrong. And I said, got to take my LSATs tomorrow. And he said, well, of course you do. You want to be a lawyer, don't you? And when I said no, he got kind of mad at me. And he said, your life is so short relative to how long you're going to be dead. Why in the world would you do something that you don't want to do? And I said, because I don't know what else I could do. And he was the one that night that said, you got to be kidding me. All I've ever heard you talk about your whole life is food and restaurants. So there it was staring me right under my nose. And it just never, ever dawned on me that that was a valid career choice for me. And in fact, you know, in the 1980s, which this was, it wasn't a natural entrepreneurial step after getting a liberal arts degree in political science. It just wasn't. The restaurant industry has become a much, much broader opportunity for a lot more entrepreneurs. And I'm really proud about that, because I think hospitality is just a really wonderful pursuit. I think the act of making other people feel better with something like good food and drink is a good thing.
We as public servants think about service in one way. I think people in the hospitality industry, they serve in a different way. But at the end of the day, it's about keeping people happy and satisfied, and whether it's a restaurant, hotel, et cetera, and very, very generous, gregarious type of people across the board.
I think that if you can find moments to feel happy, and my definition of happiness is when at that particular moment, there's nowhere else you'd rather be. That's not a bad place to be. And I think that if you can do that in a restaurant where people get to gather and be with each other and take time from their lives, the word restaurant comes from the French word to restore. And I think restaurants at their best do that. I think also restaurants, and this is something that I've learned throughout my career here in New York City, beginning with Union Square Cafe. I'll never forget when I decided to call it Union Square Cafe, a lot of people in 1985 said, that's not a very good thing to do, because Union Square is, you know, a pretty shady area. And I said, but what if we could help make it better? What if by naming our restaurant after it, it would imply that we had a stake in making it better? I think the thing I learned through Union Square Cafe and then through Gramercy Tavern and then many, many restaurants after that was that restaurants can also be placemakers. Restaurants become a magnet for people, without which those people likely would not have gone to that place. And I love really the discovery that restaurants have given me of my own city. You know, when we opened Manhattan on the 60th floor, tower of 28 Liberty, I had a view of this island that I'd never seen before and then could give that view to other people. When we opened Shake Shack in downtown Brooklyn, which juts out onto the street, I had a view of the city I had never seen before with people around me, feeling good, feeling safe. It's one of my favorite parts of restaurants. In fact, that's why so many of them are named for where they are.
Danny, as you know, 75% of new restaurants fail. So you just mentioned Union Square Cafe, which you opened at age 27. Thankfully, far from failing, your first restaurant flourished. Why?
It didn't flourish right off the bat, just to be honest. I mean, I'll never forget the first handful of days. We couldn't get you your appetizer within 45 minutes. You would never have come back if you had had those experiences. And the only reason you might have come back is that we had a refrigerator called the medicine cabinet, and that's where I kept all kinds of bottles of dessert wine. And if you were angry, which most people were, you were going to get poured as much dessert wine as it took till you got happy. We would do anything to make sure you left happy. But we did get a wonderful review from the New York Times about 3 or 4 months after we opened. And we went from 0 to 60 right off the bat. So while it wasn't overnight, I think the degree to which we've had success has to do with two things. Number one is our primary motivation when we go to work, as I've said, is however you felt when you came in. Our aim is that you just feel a little bit better when you leave. So we're going to sprinkle some dust on you, and that magic dust should make you feel a little bit better. Number two is, to the degree that we've had success, it's because we don't really believe in our own success. I think it's just not important to us. It's important to us to achieve our personal best, but I learned this lesson from my grandfather early on, and he heard me complaining one day about a horrible review we had gotten in the New York Times. This was, when I say horrible, it was 2 stars and we had really hoped for 3. So it wasn't that horrible, but it was below what our expectations were. This was for when we first opened 11 Madison Park. And he said, the first thing you need to understand is that there's a reason they're called restaurant critics and not restaurant praisers. They're just doing their job. That's their job, is to criticize. Number two, he said, he hated that I went into the restaurant business because he wanted me to go into the investment business with him, which was what he did for his whole life in Chicago. He said, for whatever reason, you went into this lousy business that happens to be in the public eye. And when you're doing something in the public eye, there's going to be a lot of people who say really good things about you. There's going to be a lot of people who say really bad things about you. And what you need to remember more than anything is you're never as good as the greatest things they're saying. And you're never quite as bad as the bad things they're saying. You just need to stay centered, keep your eye on your own prize, and build a team that wants to go there with you. And I just love that advice, because does a good review feel good? You bet it does. Does a bad review sting? Of course it does, but it doesn't really matter. Success is knowing what you want and keeping your own score and staying focused on that.
So speaking of being in the public eye and restaurant critics, I mean, these days, especially with the internet and social media, everyone can be a critic or a praiser. What do you think about the rise of crowdsourced critics like Yelp?
It doesn't really matter what I think, because it exists no matter what. So I have to be aware of it. We, at the restaurant level, try to stay in very, very close contact with our guests. Most people these days make their reservations online, and then most online reservation platforms give you the opportunity within hours to review the meal. And we love that, because we want to get that feedback immediately. And then our leaders reach back to people. If there was a problem, we want to have that conversation with you before you go shout it in the town square. I mean, and so the public forum is fine, but I'd rather have had the conversation with you first, because I believe most people come to a restaurant hoping to have a good time, not hoping to have a bad time. I believe most restaurants want you to have a good time, not a bad time. I want our team members, if it's your server, let's say, or a cook or whomever, the bartender, they need to own that experience, and they need to do whatever it takes themselves to be aware of whether they are doing our number one goal, is that you leave a little happier than however you came. And if they're not aware and they're not thinking about that, chances are less good that we're going to win.
You know, you've got these crowdsourced reviews, and then you've also got the reviews that you were just talking about, the traditional New York Times or Michelin process. In some ways, they can make or break restaurants, particularly for new restaurateurs, people that don't have a reputation. But I think I, in particular, remember a 2012 review that a New York Times critic wrote about Guy Fieri's new Times Square restaurant. It went viral, as I'm sure you remember. And while it may have brought a good laugh to many New Yorkers, it seemed to me to be more like an attempt to create a viral moment than a serious review. What was your impression, not necessarily about that specific review, but about these types of reviews? Because it seems that when you read reviews of restaurants in the 80s and 90s, and then you read them now, it feels like critics are, like the traditional critics, are having to maybe compete for eyeballs with these crowdsourced reviews. And so they feel they have to be a bit more ostentatious, maybe a bit more critical. But I want to get your thoughts, being that you've read many of them and been the subject of so many of them.
Well, I think you hit it right on the head. I think that there was a time in the early days of restaurant writing or restaurant criticism where the writer could justifiably make the case, or the publication could justifiably make the case, we're doing the consumer a favor by trying something and, you know, making it clear in advance what we recommend and also warning you away from the things that are less good. That's got some value. And I think you're absolutely right. Now that every single human being has a soapbox and an audience as large as the world wants it to be, you could make the case that we don't need restaurant criticism as a public consumer good, because there's many, many ways that you can assess information before a restaurant review. So what I've noticed in the last handful of years are two things. The restaurant critics who write for, let's say, mainstream publications have to actually form a whole new raison d'etre. And it is, I've noticed, to be more of a social commentator than a food critic. And increasingly what you're seeing is, here's who you will see when you go to a restaurant. Here's the role that that restaurant plays in the fabric of the city. Here's how that restaurant treats animals and plants and people. That has become more of what you see. It's almost as if you started off with news and now you have commentary.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back with more from our conversation with Danny Meyer. But I want to take a second to encourage our listeners to get vaccinated today by visiting vax4nyc.nyc.gov. You can also call 877-VAX4NYC. It's never been easier to get a COVID-19 vaccination in New York City. All New Yorkers age 12 and older are eligible for the vaccine. Those who are fully vaccinated can more safely gather with friends and enjoy other benefits of vaccination. Many vaccination sites in the city no longer require appointments. To find a vaccination site near you, including those that take appointments, use the city's vaccine finder at vax4nyc.nyc.gov. And remember, even after you are vaccinated, you should continue to wear a face covering and practice physical distancing when in a public indoor space, outdoors in crowded areas, or when attending gatherings with unvaccinated people.
Thanks for listening, and back to you, Bess.
You mentioned earlier that restaurants can make a neighborhood. I actually still remember going to the original Shake Shack with my dad, who worked at Credit Suisse, and I actually still go there today. But, you know, as Shake Shack has grown in popularity, there's one in downtown Brooklyn, but now there's Shake Shack all across the globe. What was your strategy for global expansion?
As with almost everything that I did back in those days, no strategy whatsoever. In fact, Shake Shack itself was not an intentional business. It was really working with the community and the city to help restore Madison Square Park. And it started when we established 11 Madison Park and Tabla, which both opened in 1998. And starting in 1996, 97, we worked with the Parks Department to create a campaign for the new Madison Square Park and succeeded with a group of community leaders in raising $11 million to restore the park. That then turned into the Madison Square Park Conservancy. And one of the visions for the Madison Square Park Conservancy, we knew that we needed to bring people to the park, because it's all well and good to have beautiful horticulture again and beautiful pathways and a nice dog run and a children's playground and safety. But if people don't use it, it's just going to revert to where it had been. So there were two visions that we had early on. One was that there would be art in the park, and the other was that one day there would be food in the park. What I didn't know was that the two would actually come together. And this was happenstance. And the happenstance was that working with the Public Art Fund of New York City, that team curated a sculptor from Thailand. And this sculptor, Nawin Ravenschenkel, had this idea to bring a piece of art to Madison Square Park that would be four taxi cabs on stilts with a working hot dog cart that he designed to look like a hot dog cart that was a taxi or something like that. And we just got a call one day, or I got a call saying, would you guys be interested in operating? He wants it to be a working hot dog cart to go with these taxi cabs. And I said, sure. My partners looked at me like I was absolutely crazy. This was the summer of 2001, before 9/11. We had extra capacity in our dining room, a private dining room kitchen at 11 Madison Park. And I said, let's see if we can do an excellent version of a hot dog cart that is incredibly hospitable. And so the obvious choice was to do Chicago style hot dogs because they have 8 classic toppings. And I wanted to see if our team members could remember everybody's favorite. Everybody has some exclusion or specific wish when they have a Chicago style hot dog, like this person hates pickle relish, this person hates mustard, whatever. So we did it. And the lines were as long as you could imagine. 9/11 happened. The city went into both an emotional and economic depression. And in the summer of 2002, the community begged us, even though the art had moved on, can you guys just please bring back your hot dog cart? So we did it again. And year 3, 2003, we did it again. About that time, we started speaking with the city, the Parks Department, the Art Commission, the Community Board, and we started speaking about whether it might make sense to have a permanent kiosk in Madison Square Park. And so we got all the approvals from everybody. I got together with my mom and a couple other businesses, and we contributed this structure to the park. We had it built modularly, and one day it wasn't there, and the next day there it was, a 20-foot by 20-foot kiosk. We called it Shake Shack, and I had sat down one day and scribbled out a menu that, in addition to hot dogs, I thought it would be good to have a couple of my other favorite things from growing up in St. Louis. To this day, 80% of the menu is exactly what I scribbled that day. But we had no idea that this would become a big business. I wanted to follow this model that I had read about in a book called The Cathedral Within by Billy Shore, which is to create a community wealth model, meaning we would contribute the building, the park would own it, the park would become the landlord, and every dollar of sales, a percentage of which would go right back into the park. And so if this worked, it would do 2 things for the community. Actually, 3 things. It would attract people, which would make the park feel safe, morning, noon, and night. It would create a revenue stream, which would be a good thing to keep the park sustained. And number 3, it would create community wealth for the buildings, whether you went to work in that community or owned property in that community or lived in the community. It should be something that made you happier that you did all those things in the community. And it checked those boxes. And the lines were incredibly long. Then we opened our second Shake Shack 5 years later. It took 5 years. And the only thing that made me really convinced we should do it is when one of my teammates said, maybe this would be a great way to curtail the line, make it a better experience. Well, the line just got longer when we opened the second one. Soon after we had 2, the Mets called to see if we wanted to be in their new place in Citi Field. We had one on the Upper East Side after that. And then we got a call from somebody who I'd never heard of before saying, we are the leading restaurant licensee in the Middle East. It's a company called Al Shaya. They're based in Kuwait. And we want Shake Shack to be our burger company in the Middle East. And this was after we had about 4 or 5 Shake Shacks. And I said, oh my gosh, if we can learn from this company how to expand, because that's what they're expert at, far away from our customer base here, wouldn't that be like a great school to go to? We can make our mistakes and learn our mistakes over there. And so we did it. And today, all these years later, Shake Shack's in 15 different countries around the world, many of the United States of America. And it's a great way to, I think, express hospitality, learn about other cultures, and hopefully export something good about our culture.
So during the pandemic, the city faced an unprecedented food insecurity crisis with supply chain shortages and many New Yorkers unable to leave their homes. We're very proud that the city and others worked to create a program to address food insecurity by delivering hundreds of millions of meals to New Yorkers. Can you talk a little bit about your work on food insecurity?
Well, I've been actively interested in food insecurity really since I was in college working at the Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome. And I've been on the board of Share Our Strength since 1992. Active with City Harvest, active with the Bedford-Stuyvesant Campaign Against Hunger. And then during the pandemic, we became very active with Rethink, which is a program that allowed us to hire back some of our team members at 3 of our restaurants where we were not permitted to serve guests indoors. And instead, we could bring our team members back, cook food, which would then be delivered to 2 places in the South Bronx for some food insecure neighborhoods. And I think that our industry has done an amazing job, not just us, but so many in our industry understand that food is love. Food is a hug. And if you can give a hug to somebody, it shouldn't just be within the four walls of your own restaurant.
Danny, the New York City Economic Development Corporation is a nonprofit corporation that serves as the city's primary entity for economic development in New York City. You recently became chair of the EDC. I'm also a member of the board and have been for about a year now. So it was a great surprise. And I think all of us were really thrilled when you accepted the position. Why did you accept the position?
Well, I think if the question is, would you like to help your city at this moment? The answer is, who wouldn't? And it's not a position I knew about or ever would have thought about, but I was happy and proud to answer the call.
What are your priorities as chair?
I feel like my job is to be a transponder of information. I receive information and then I transmit it. I'm getting lots and lots of input from people who have great ideas. What's amazing to me is that the team at EDC is so competent and entrepreneurial and quick that they don't need me. But if I'm in this position, I feel like if I can be a filter for good ideas and share them with the team there, Rachel being the leader, that's probably my highest and best use. It's important for me to express genuinely the optimism I feel for the city's recovery and, you know, be a cheerleader for something I know will happen.
So I am a huge Top Chef fan. Top Chef and the Food Network, I feel like, has really changed the food industry in a lot of ways. Suddenly there are cameras and there are celebrity chefs, and you want to go to this restaurant because of the celebrity chef. How has the introduction of TV cameras into the kitchen and the creation of celebrity chefs changed the industry in your mind?
In my opinion, it's a double-edged sword. I think on one hand, it's an important hand. It has attracted a lot of people to our industry who otherwise may never have chosen this line of work. That's a good thing. On the other hand, I think hospitality is an act of humility. And it's an act of saying, you know, this thing I know how to do really well, I'm doing it for you. And I think that there can be a danger if you take reality TV too far, where the seduction of being a celebrity is more about me than it is about what I did for you. So I try to balance both sides of that.
If you could go to any of your restaurants, past or present, which one would you go to and what meal would you order?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. I think I would go to Union Square Cafe when Michael Romano was the chef. And I would have such an amazing meal. I would start off with one of his pastas, like pappardelle al sugo di coniglio, which is the rabbit ragu that he made. And then I would probably have roast breast of veal, or I might just have a steak and some fagioli beans, and I would drink a lot of good Italian wine.
All right, so we are introducing a new game. It's called the Danny Meyer Chef Burger Game. Oh, I'd love to be a Danny Meyer Chef Burger. This game makes no sense, I guarantee. Because if I were a Danny Meyer Chef Burger, I would know what the two choices would be. Oh, I wish I were a Danny Meyer Chef Burger. Two choices we will give to thee. Because if I were a Danny Meyer Chef Burger, we would give all the Chef Burgers for free. All right, so if you didn't catch the game, we're going to give you two options and you pick one. So ready? MoMA or the Met?
MoMA.
Shake Shack or Gramercy Tavern?
Depends.
Okay. Margaritaville or Bubba Gump in Times Square?
Shake Shack.
Okay, last question. A frozen custard or gooey butter cake?
Frozen custard.
And that concludes the Danny Meyer Chef Burger Game.
I want to thank the great Danny Meyer for joining us today on City Hall Pass. We know how busy you are, Danny. And we not only appreciate all the things you've done for this city, but we really appreciate you taking on this role at EDC. I think we're all looking forward to your creative ideas, and we just can't wait to work with you and just see the great things that you're going to bring to the city in your new role. Thank you so much, Danny.
Thank you, Kapil.
I want to again thank our guest, Danny Meyer, for taking time out of his incredibly busy schedule to sit down with us. As a huge fan of his food, it was a surreal experience to talk to Danny, who is such a humble and thoughtful person. Danny's contribution to his industry has provided so many of us with priceless experiences, and his contribution to New York City continues to be invaluable and deeply impactful. We hope you enjoyed this conversation and looking forward to talking to you soon on another episode of City Hall Pass. This podcast is brought to you by the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor of New York City, with support from the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment,